KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, or at least Christmas shopping lists. We're going to hear how the tech world is ramping up for the holiday season later this hour with Todd Bishop. Also, film critic Robert Horton joins us. Another high-profile Canadian lawmaker has been caught up in a widening scandal. Here with details on that and other stories from Canada, Les Lane, provincial affairs columnist for the Victoria Times Columnist. Hi, Les.
Morning, Marcy.
Who's the lawmaker in question and what did she do?
Senator Pamela Wallin. We have appointed senators in Canada with not quite as much power as U.S. senators. She was named 3 or 4 years ago to the Senate. Very high-profile former broadcaster known across Canada. And she is in a big mess of trouble based on her exorbitant travel claims. She's appointed to represent Saskatchewan in Ottawa in the Senate. In the space of almost 4 years, she's racked up $500,000 in travel claims, which is wildly out of line by most people's standards. But the particular problem with her is a lot of them have absolutely no basis or justification, and there's been a widening net. This has been going on for a year. There's four senators deeply implicated in some very questionable expense claims, and hers are just as bad as the other three. She's claiming expenses or basically claiming travel on official business when there's absolutely no justification for it, and all boiled over a period of last week or earlier this week when a sort of forensic audit was released, and they seem to have her cold on a number of fronts.
And she says that the auditors are looking at the wrong kind of statistics, that they changed the rules midway.
Yeah, there's been percolating for several years now, the kind of growing realization that they're very loosey-goosey in their standards in the Senate, and they've been tightening them up. She's claiming they're holding her retroactively to a higher standard that was imposed last year. I don't know that that's going to fly with the public because this isn't going over well. It's quite inflammatory, some of the claims she's making, and particularly relevant in her case is that the Deloitte auditors went through it and got all the evidence they could from her and got her electronic calendar and have found hundreds of entries on that calendar were kind of retroactively changed or deleted, which she says she has a justifiable reason to do that, and did it on the advice of another senator, although he denies offering that advice. But it does not look good, and it doesn't really make her case at all.
Now, Les, you mentioned that she's part of a wider scandal. Why is it such a big deal?
It's the Canadian Senate being appointed, and they're kind of the body of second thought. They look at Canadian legislation, and the theoretical concept is that they just reflect on it and give it final approval and don't do much else, and make a lot of money for not doing much of anything and get jobs that institutionalized patronage. The prime minister in power appoints his friends to the Senate. That's just the way it's been for over 100 years. So Canadian senators are never held in very high esteem, but now the kind of dare I say, pigs at the trough mentality is kicking in, and it's just heightened a lot of the suspicions about the Senate. But the fundamental problem is that to change the Senate, you have to make a constitutional amendment, and for any number of political reasons, it's almost impossible to do anything about it. So the traditional pattern over 100 years has been we get continually outraged by the Senate and their antics, but it's almost impossible to do anything about it.
How directly is this tied to the prime minister, aside from the fact that he makes the appointments?
The problem with this latest outrage is that three of the four senators in who are kind of flagrantly out of line on their expenses were all appointed by Prime Minister Stephen Harper. He kind of indirectly wears this, and he's been obliquely defending a couple of them up until recently. Now a couple of them are under police investigation, so they've cut ties and they've suspended Wallen from the Conservative caucus within the Senate. But it just sort of reflects badly on his judgment and on broadcasting in general. The other one, Mike Duffy, he held center stage over the last couple of weeks with claims purporting to represent Prince Edward Island in the Senate, but showing no evidence that he lives there. The pattern is that they represent outlying regions and then move to the bright lights and basically live there. So their travel claims back home, home in quotes, they just simply don't live there.
Fascinating. I want to turn to Toronto, where 2 weeks after an 18-year-old was killed by police in downtown Toronto, protests continue. Can you explain what happened initially that sparked this?
Yeah, this is another wrongful use of force episode in Toronto. They've had several of these in the last few years, and this one looks, on the face of it, pretty egregious. An 18-year-old Syrian youth, Sami Yatim, apparently mentally disturbed or under extreme duress. He had some problems. He was on a streetcar, pulled a knife, and threatened people on the streetcar. Eventually, they all fled. He was alone on the bus. It was a full-fledged police incident. Standing near the front of the bus with the doors open, no one in the bus, surrounded by police officers who were yelling at him and obviously trying to defuse the situation. And in the time, kind of the modern tradition now, it was all caught on a cell phone video, and it shows at least one officer open fire on him in the middle of this standoff, shot him 9 times. Subsequent evidence showed that he was tasered as well. He died in hospital. And the question people are asking is, obviously, there must have been a better way to bring this to a happier conclusion. The situation reflects a couple of similar cases going back a couple of years, and it's in Toronto, it's kind of crystallized, very similar to the Jakansky case at the Vancouver airport a few years ago. There's now, they've gone over and above in terms of the routine official response to these sorts of things. The police chief in Toronto has appointed a pretty respected former judge, Dennis O'Connor, to do a more or less independent inquiry into this and to look at use of force and how to handle these situations better.
Well, we're going to go from Toronto to your own home of Victoria, which is going to the birds.
There's a big change. People, ornithologists and bird watchers, are just finding a kind of a very significant but maybe gradual change over time. The long story is takes a while to tell. It's just a kind of change in the ecology of the birds over the city. But this, in short form, the sidewalks are a lot messier than they used to be. The eagles have rebounded. They're probably in the U.S., I guess, to some extent, but particularly here in Canada. It used to be an unusual sight. They're very commonplace now. Right along the waterfront, which is where the seagulls used to live. It's dawning on the seagulls that that's a no-win situation when the eagles kind of reclaim the waterfront. So a lot of more seagulls have moved downtown. They're perching and nesting in buildings, and people are hosing and scrubbing the sidewalks off a lot more than they used to in town. It was just noticed by a reporter in Victoria here talking to a number of bird watchers. And that is one of several changes that reflect a lot of things going on in the skies overhead.
Well, it's good news that the eagles have rebounded, and there's some other species that are on the swing up from almost extinction.
Yeah, there was a purple martin. I don't know that bird offhand. I've seen one or two of them in the wild, but they were down to 5 breeding pairs in 1985, apparently, which is right on the verge of extinction. And there was a very concerted effort. You see particular types of birdhouses, purple martin boxes, in some new developments on the waterfront. They've been nurtured back to health. Now there's about 800 parrots around southern Vancouver Island. This is almost a direct result of this nest box program, which is very nice. And Cooper's hawks are particularly noticeable bird are back very significantly around the city as well.
But they're not pooping on your sidewalks.
No, they're a little easier to take, yeah.
So, it sounds like short of killing off all the eagles again, the gulls are there to stay.
Well, there's someone on the radio this morning, local radio, we've got a falconer who's who's interested in operating downtown,
wow.
Which would make for some very dramatic bird watching downtown. I'm not sure how that's going to fly.
You mean he wants to set loose his hawks to, okay.
That would be a noon hour show for some people to watch.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow. All right. Well, we'll check in about the bird situation.
Sure.
And we're going to go from your sidewalks to Under the Sea, a search for the wreckage of a 19th century ship is going to resume.
Yeah, this has been going on my entire adult life when I think about it now. All kinds of explorers have been looking for the remains of John Franklin was one of those kind of traditional or typical mid-19th century English explorers. He had two ships in a command, the HMS Terror and the HMS Erebus. They set out 1845 to find the Northwest Passage, sailed around the Arctic and got locked in the ice and disappeared. And there's been years, decades of research into this, and they found that Franklin and 128 men were lost up north. They found several bodies, and they found cairns and burial grounds, and it's been because it's so preservative, the dry and the cold, the bodies were in good shape. There's been an extensive amount of study into the bodies and some interesting findings. There's some theories that they died of the lead solder used in the canned foods of the day, all kinds of stuff like that. But the one thing they haven't found is the two ships. And the relatively shallow water up there, maybe 10, 12, 15 meters in those various, in that big archipelago around the northern islands, just short of the Arctic Ocean. But they've looked, this is the fifth kind of federally mandated exploration looking for these two ships, and they're setting out again this week. They're going to spend 6 weeks mapping and doing sonar studies around some of the suspected routes looking for these ships.
Well, the sonar studies are to see if there's any reason to go below the surface, because I was just wondering as you were talking whether there is any evidence that the wreckage is still there, or if it maybe broke apart and just dispersed.
Well, you have to wonder about that too. I was thinking there might not be much left to find after this, 160 years.
Yes.
After this length of time, and given the advances in, if they can find the Titanic, they can find anything these days. There may be nothing left to find. I think it's also considered just a good exercise to operate scientifically in the far north. Kind of people use it not as an excuse, but as just an interesting academic kind of task force thing to look at. But they're getting kind of, it's turning almost into a bit of a routine over the last 15, 20 years to go up and spend a few weeks in the summer looking for John Franklin's ships.
Interesting. Well, it'll be great news if they find it, won't it?
It'll be quite a find. Yeah, there'd be a lot of interesting artifacts.
Les Lane is provincial columnist for the Victoria Times columnist. He's been filling in for Vaughn Palmer, our usual Wednesday guest. Nice talking with you, Les.
Yeah, take care, Marcy. Thank you.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Morning, I'm Jack Walters. Have you got questions about the rules of the road? Former Seattle traffic cop John Abraham answers your questions today in the noon hour. You can get your question in now by calling 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
They say you are what you eat, so how much media do you consume every day? Are you gorging yourself on everything in sight, snacking between meals, sneaking the occasional tweet? I'm Audie Cornish. Look, if you've tried all the other news outlets but just aren't seeing results, check out the All Things Considered diet. Weekdays. More news, less filler.
All Things Considered beginning this afternoon at 2 o'clock on KUOW 94.9.
Support for KUOW comes from Youth Care, providing education and employment training, shelter, and housing programs to help get homeless youth off the streets and preparing for life. More information at www.youthcare.org.
71 degrees Seattle in Seattle right now. A high today projected to be in the mid-70s, partly sunny skies. Tonight's low temperature around 60, mostly cloudy with a 40% chance of rain. And for Thursday, again, a high in the mid-70s, mostly cloudy skies.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Through these many years, Robert has reviewed movies on KYW, and he tells me that the most common question he's asked by people who hear him on the radio, what are your favorite movies, Robert? And today, he's going to reveal that list.
Ooh, wow. It's a reveal.
At least that's what you tell me you're going to do.
Yes, it is a common question, and so I have to say something when people ask, because I can't just list off 100 movies, although that would probably be the correct answer. So I have actually come up with a few that are Die Hard. These are my favorites.
And you gave me the top three.
Yes.
Starting with, in no particular order, I'm sure, North by Northwest.
Yeah.
Are they in order?
That would be kind of at the top. That would be sort of my go-to number one, I think. Yeah.
North by Northwest. Well, before you talk about it, let's listen to a clip, shall
okay.
we? This is from the auction scene.
Has anyone ever told you that you overplay your various roles rather severely, Mr. Kaplan? First, you're the outraged Madison Avenue man who claims he's been mistaken for someone else. Then you play the fugitive from justice, supposedly trying to clear his name of a crime he knows he didn't commit. Now you play the peevish lover, stung by jealousy and betrayal. Seems to me you fellows could stand a little less training from the FBI and a little more from the actor's studio.
Apparently, the only performance that'll satisfy you is when I play dead.
In your very next role, you'll be quite convincing, I assure you.
North by Northwest.
Yes.
A very intriguing clip, if you've never seen
it. I like that clip. Yeah, that's a funny one. That's James Mason as the villain, trying to lay a little menace on Cary Grant, who's our hero, who's a guy who has... He's kind of an advertising man, exactly from the Mad Men era, actually. Mm. 1959 is the film. The film's release, and he has been mistaken for someone else just through total random chance. The bad guys think he's a spy, and he gets chased over half of America, ultimately to Mount Rushmore, which is, if you're at the top of Mount Rushmore, there's really only one place to go, and that makes for the exciting climax of North by Northwest. And I love the film. Of course, it's a Hitchcock film, we should say. And along with just being a totally entertaining movie, and one that I encountered in my adolescence for the first time. I also think it's kind of a metaphor for movie going. It's kind of like why we go to the movies, what happens to this guy. He's in his normal life, and then he gets into something that is just totally fantastical. It's this weird narrative. He has little control over it, and then he comes out at the end, and he's okay. And that's kind of like why we go to movies. You want to have that experience and be someone else maybe for a little while, as this guy is. I think Hitchcock was very aware of that kind of thing. And it's why he was drawn to make movies, which, as he said, were not slices of life, but slices of cake.
Oh, I like that.
That's how he wanted them to be taken. And North by Northwest is just kind of unsurpassed as a nice slice of cake.
And why do you think it stands out above his other movies? At least to you.
Well, this is an interesting question, because this brings us to, you know, favorite versus maybe best. Because I don't think it's Hitchcock's best film, necessarily. I wouldn't say that. But it's just kind of my favorite. And so it has a lot to do with seeing it on late night TV when I was 13 on, you know, like the Como big movie on Saturday night. And and just being transfixed by it. And then you have it in your life for a while, and you realize how much you like it, and then you get to revisit it once in a while, and you start to appreciate how good Cary Grant really is. Wow, that guy is excellent. And in my case, 10 years ago, I got to interview Eva Marie Saint on stage, and she's the woman who meets Cary Grant on a train in the film. And that kind of put another piece to it for me, and I got to tell her how much I'd wanted to run into her on a train for the last 30 years of my life, stuff like that. So it's a favorite. It's a desert island movie, and I don't need to make a claim for it as Hitchcock's best, because when you're making your favorites list, it's completely about what it means to you and not some kind of yardstick that's imaginary or set some kind of standard.
Do you ever find that when you watch a movie over and over and over again, that something about sitting down at that movie to start it again is not like getting back into the womb, but it's sort of meditative and peaceful?
Yeah, yeah. If you want to extend it, it's almost kind of a ritual, mm-hmm. sacramental even. Like, oh, good, here's this movie, and I know how special it is to me, and turn off the lights and go for it. Yeah, that does happen, especially with something you know kind of well.
Now, your second movie on the three favorites list is, we don't have a clip for it because it's in French.
Ah, well.
And so those of you who speak French could have appreciated it, but since we don't all, I didn't. But what is this movie, Jules and Jim?
Quel dommage. It is, Jules and Jim is a film from 1961, and it was the third feature directed by François Truffaut. And again, it's a film classic. It's accepted as a great film and all that. But why it's on my list is just, I think, again, as is going to be true of a number of these films we talk about, I saw it in adolescence. I think it was on like a PBS series that showed, you know, here are some great foreign films. And I'd sit there, and because I was getting interested in movies, I'd try to watch them and try to understand them. Most of the time I didn't understand them, but I had a sense that something was going on. And Jules and Jim especially hit me. I just found it really fascinating. It's a story of two friends, two close friends before the First World War, who kind of fall in love with the same woman. And over the course of the years, they have many experiences with her, and it's a very interesting story. It was written by a guy named Henri Pierre Rocher, who actually sort of lived a version of the story, and then 40 years later, or even like 50 years later, wrote the novel. He wrote his first novel when he was very old, quite old, and he only wrote one other novel, which Truffaut also filmed, Two English Girls. But it's one of the, when I saw the movie, and as I kind of grew up with it and thinking about it, to me it was just a film that suggested that somehow life could be different from the way you saw it around you, and maybe the way people were telling you life was, and it's all about art and love and friendship and this kind of intense feeling about, you know, loving novels and movies and painting. And it just kind of planted a seed that I don't think I ever got over. Because look at what happened to me, Katie.
I'm jack of all trades.
I mean, you know, yeah, you sort of get into something very unprofitable and then you're lost. But it really is, I think it affected me strongly. And at a certain early age, I knew that I would not have a normal life. And somehow Jules and Jim is part of the reason for that.
That's great. Jules and Jim, I'm going to play a clip from your last one, your top three, because I think people might just recognize this.
They might.
What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down. Hey, that's a pretty good idea. I'll give you the moon, Barry.
I'll take it. Then what?
Well, then you could swallow it and it'd all dissolve, see? And the moonbeams that shoot out of your fingers and your toes and the ends of your hair. Am I talking too much?
Yes. Why don't you kiss her instead of talking her to death?
Good advice.
Always good advice. Yes, yes.
So that was It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah. Film directed by Frank Capra after the Second World War. Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed in the film. And again, I found it in adolescence on television, and strangely, it was before the film had been discovered as a classic. It had kind of fallen by the wayside, was not mentioned amongst well-known American movies, let alone a classic, and it was rediscovered in kind of in the late 60s, early 70s on television. And I don't know when I would have seen it first, 73 or 74 or something like that. And it's another movie that you grow up with, and I think most people who like the film feel one way about it when they're 20 and another way about it when you're 30, and maybe when you're 50 you even think it's better than you thought in terms of its observations. And it's beloved as a kind of sentimental classic, but it's actually a movie that shows both the upside of the American dream but also the dark side of the American dream. And it's kind of nightmarish. It begins with a man about to commit suicide, not just a man but the hero of the movie, and he's about to kill himself. And it's a really interesting film. It's a little more interesting maybe than it generally gets due. And there was something about watching that movie early on and thinking, what is this? I've never even heard of this film. And then watching it kind of blossom into this thing that that really does get a great profile, that was really kind of cool to watch. And it's like any of these movies, you carry it with you, and somehow it's always with you.
And now that you're a little older, is there something about it you appreciate differently than from when you were younger?
I don't know. I think just you could sense that there was a lot of wisdom somehow in the story of George Bailey and the trade-offs that this guy makes between being a world conqueror, as he imagines himself to be as a young man, and then not being that as he gets older and being okay with that and eventually being all right with that. Probably is a fairly universal sort of story, and it's beautifully worked out in that film.
I'm speaking with Robert Horton, a film critic, longtime contributor to KOW. Find his reviews in the Everett Herald and on his blog, The Crop Duster. So all these three movies, your top favorites, they're all old, Robert.
Is that right? Are they old?
Well, older. Yeah. You know,
I don't
60s.
Have many. Yeah, there aren't many on my list that are recent films.
Does that say something about how you feel about modern day movie making?
No, I don't think so. I think it says, because I see a lot of movies now that I love, but I think it comes down to that, just that favorite idea is something that, like if I made out a list of favorite books, I think they'd all be things that I read before I was 20. And just, it's certain things don't go quite as deep as they ever do when you're, you know, 13 years old or something. And that goes into the category of favorite. And then you see things later that you esteem maybe higher, but, you know, my Island of the Blue Dolphins. I mean, I've read better books than that, but it's kind of one of my favorites still.
That's so interesting that you say that, because I would argue that some of my favorite movies are also from my adolescence, but
yeah,
some of them, I mean, these all hold up.
Mm-hmm.
Some of mine.
Some don't, yes.
Some of mine, I would almost be embarrassed to share with other human beings.
And that's okay. That's all right. Even if it's still a favorite, I think that's actually okay. You can make a case for it.
Or keep it a secret.
It's okay to keep these things secret
sometimes. You have even more on this list. Those are the top three, and then you have a bunch that follow, and one of them is a movie called The Gift.
It's a gift.
Sorry. Yes. Should we hear the clip first, or you want to explain something?
You know, It's a Gift. I'll say that It's a Gift is a film from the early 30s starring W.C. Fields, one of my favorite comedians. And the movie is full of just like comic set pieces that are really funny, but it also has this weird, surreal streak of just things happening out of the blue. And this gentleman who comes along and W.C. Fields is trying to get some sleep on his porch, and he's interrupted by a fellow who is in search of someone. And it's never explained. It has nothing else to do with anything in the movie. It just happens, and it's brilliant.
Let's take a listen.
Is this 1726 Prill Avenue?
No.
Is there a Prill Avenue in this neighborhood?
I don't know.
Do you know a man by the name of LaFong? Carl LaFong. Capital L, small A. Capital F, small O, small N, small G. LaFong. Carl LaFong.
No, I don't know Carl LaFong. Capital L, small A. Capital F, small O, small N, small G. And if I did know Carl LaFong, I wouldn't admit it.
I mean, what can you say except that if you were a practicing surrealism or Dada back in the late 20s and early 30s, I think you would embrace that moment. I don't know why it's there. It is just, it makes me laugh myself silly every time I hear it. And that man is out there somewhere looking for Carl LaFong still.
Still today.
We don't know why.
He might be outside your house
he
right
could
now.
Be. He could be. I would try that. So every once in a while, that's run through my mind and I've thought about just yelling up at someone. We won't go into it.
So W.C. Fields, though, is this common to movies he would do to throw in some sort of surrealist aside? Or
yeah, there are definitely weird asides in a lot of his movies. And you could almost argue that they're at their best when they're kind of just doing that. Because some of his films, you can tell that the studio said, you know, you really have to have a plot here. So go with something like this and this and this. Whereas It's a Gift is wonderful because it's just, it does have a plot, but it's also just sheer craziness, and it feels very modern if you watch it today, 80 years after it was made.
How about Some Like It Hot?
Another comedy, and just a great film. Billy Wilder directed. It's also from 1959, and I like it in part because it is a comedy, but actually I think of it as a romance, and it's a romance about, in slapstick terms, and it's about these two guys who are in the 1920s and they are forced to wear women's clothing and join an all-girl band, as they would have been called back then. And they are forced to see things from the other side, literally. And it's actually kind of works out in a beautiful way. Even though it's, you know, totally funny, it's really slapstick, and Marilyn Monroe is gorgeous and very funny in it. But it's kind of a moral tale in a strange way. Although I'm sure Billy Wilder wouldn't have said that because he wants people to go see his movie and laugh a lot. But it's a beautiful film, actually, even more so than it is a funny film. But it's a very funny film.
Well, should we listen to a clip?
All right.
This is Daphne and Josephine meeting Sugarcane, which is played by Marilyn Monroe, on the train.
I want you to think I'm a drinker. I can stop anytime I want to, only I don't want to, especially when I'm blue.
We understand.
All the girls drink. It's just that I'm the one that gets caught. Story of my life. I always get the fuzzy end of the lollipop.
Aww.
Even from that little bit, you can kind of see how well Marilyn Monroe does funny stuff, but also is somehow still vulnerable. She always has that kind of slightly vulnerable quality, and that really comes off very, very well here. I've loved that movie for many, many years.
Well, there's plenty more on this list, Robert, and we're running out of time. So maybe I'll put them up on the weekday on KYW Facebook page.
Fair enough.
But before we end, why don't you talk about this documentary that's coming out?
Yeah, we do have things opening this weekend.
Yes, it's not all about the past.
No. I would recommend, especially if you're cinematically inclined, there's an interesting documentary called Persistence of Vision. It's about a guy named Richard Williams who spent decades working on a great work of animation that never came to fruition, that he was never able to finish. And so it's one of those fascinating kind of Grand Crusade movies that's doomed to failure, and you know it is from the beginning of the movie. But a really interesting psychological study, and also it has lots of clips of this great film that he was working on. That's opening at the Grand Illusion.
And you have another one, Slapstick Savants?
Yeah, just early word on a couple of series coming up
in
Seattle. I think it's the 23rd that SIFF is going to be playing a collection of comedies, Slapstick Savants, or is it Savants Slapstick? Who knows? Is a bunch of silent and sound films that showcase some of the great comedians of that era. I also would mention Seattle Art Museum is doing its annual film noir series every fall, a pioneering series, and this one kicks in on September 9th, I'm going to say, is the opening date, and is another great slate of film noir, those late 40s, early 50s films that are almost completely irresistible well-curated, as always, and it always sells out, so you might want to act now.
So bring your 12-year-old, too, because then they might end up finding that a film noir is their favorite film.
That's about the age I first saw Double Indemnity, so yes.
Yes.
If my sorry example means anything, then that could happen.
We could form young minds. Yeah. This weekend, as early as this weekend. Robert Horton is a film critic, longtime contributor to KYW. You can find his reviews in the Everett Herald and at his blog, The Crop Duster. Robert also hosts The Magic Lantern, a monthly series of discussions on cinema at the Fry Art Museum. And you have something going on this Friday.
I'll be there on Sunday at the Fry. I'll be talking about The City. In film, which I hope is an interesting idea. And then, yeah, Friday afternoon at 5, I'll be at Northwest Film Forum with the other members of Framing Pictures' monthly panel about stuff that's going on in the movies.
Always a pleasure to have you on, Robert.
Thank you, Katie.
This is Weekday.
It's 1041, KUOW 94.9. How is technology changing not just dating, but weddings? We'll hear from an etiquette expert this afternoon at 1:50.
Starting on September 3rd, it's The Record on KUOW.
Inspiration from music, arts, and culture.
Smart analysis of national and global issues.
News and stories that matter about Seattle and the Puget Sound region.
I'm Ross Reynolds.
And I'm Marcy Silman. Join us and Steve Scher.
Starting September 3rd, The Record spins every weekday from noon to 2.
Hope you can join us.
KUOW and Seattle Center present Festal, a year-long series of events highlighting the distinct cultures and common threads of ethnic communities in the Pacific Northwest. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
72 degrees in Seattle. Looks to be sort of hazy out there. Today's high temperature in the mid-70s, partly sunny, and tonight a low around 60, mostly cloudy, with a 40% chance of rain.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman, and as you just heard a little blip ago, we have a new show coming out. It's called The Record, and Weekday lead producer Katie Sewell is here with me to talk a little bit about what's going to happen.
Yeah, The Record starts September 3rd. It's going to be on from noon to 2, and it's going to be a new project, a new conglomeration of everyone who works at KUOW practically, the staff of Weekday, the staff of The Conversation, KUOW Presents, interviewers, all coming together to create a new show. Hopefully there will be strength in numbers and you're going to hear amazing new things that we weren't able to pull off before on Weekday in The Conversation. Not that we didn't pull off some amazing things.
We pulled off some 20 years of amazing things on Weekday.
I know. So this is the new project. Like you've been talking about, fall is for new things. It's a period of transition, and Weekday will be going away. The Conversation will be going away, and this new show will grow up in its place. So it's a little bit sad because, you know, we love Weekday, and we've loved being here all these many years, but we're also excited to see what's coming up.
And to celebrate 20 years of Weekday, we're going to be running, starting Monday the 19th, 2 weeks looking back, digging back into our archives, which 20 years of archives, that's a lot of great interviews, great material.
There are some good gemstones in there. And as you know, Marcy, I'm not going to be working on this show.
I know, and that makes me sad.
Yes, and it wasn't anything personal, no. It was that we got another opportunity. My husband got the chance to study in Rome for the year, and we decided, when is this chance going to come again?
Never. So, and we're all very jealous.
Yes. And I love working at KYW and I love working for our listeners. But I think it's maybe time to try something new for a year. And if anyone wants to keep in touch with me and find out what projects I'm working on, email me at radiokatie@gmail.com.
K-A-T-Y.
Yes. Radiokatie@gmail.com. And I'll let you know.
We look forward to hearing from you on the air and via email. And just one of our listeners emailed in, what about The Takeaway? Well, don't worry. The Takeaway with John Hockenberry moves to 9 a.m. and a brand new show called Here and Now. A new show from NPR is going to run from 10 to noon and then we follow at noon.
Yep.
So it's going to be great.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Okay. Thanks, Katie. And we're going to go right from Katie to Christmas season. It's hard to believe, but it's the middle of August. Retailers and tech companies are already thinking about what they're going to sell you for the holidays. Todd Bishop, co-founder and national editor of GeekWire, great to have you back in yet. So the main thing that I get from your advice is don't go shopping yet.
That's right. It was funny. My wife and I, just this past week, her contract is up and we need to move her from her old iPhone 3 to something newer. And she reminded me, she said, wait a second, we don't want to do that now. We want to wait. And then lo and behold, the next day, Apple came out with the news, or the rumor came out, that they're going to be announcing. It's interesting how these news phases happen.
It's first, not news yet.
Right, right. We got the news that there will be news, possibly, on September 10th. Apple is expected to announce the new iPhone.
And I heard possibly the new iPad.
That is a possibility. There are lots of rumors about the iPad. But this is traditionally, or at least recently, traditionally, the time that Apple announces the iPhone leading up to the holiday shopping season. And so traditionally what they've done simultaneously with that is reduce the price of their older devices. So, for example, if you want to go for an iPhone 5,
it'll be $99.
I'll hold you to that, Marcy.
No, I'm just saying that's what they did with the iPhone 4.
Exactly.
As opposed to the 4. The 4 was 99 cents last year, and then the 4S was $99. So will there be a 5S? Is that what we're looking for?
That's a definite possibility, although who knows what Apple has up its sleeve. You know, there's a lot of pressure on Tim Cook right now to try and prove that the company has you know, some of that magic left in it. And, you know, Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, just this past week was basically really downplaying Apple's chances for, you know, keeping that magic going without Steve Jobs. And so there's a lot of pressure on the company right now, and it'll be interesting to see if they can pull that rabbit out of the hat on September 10th.
All right, so don't buy anything till September 10th. In the meantime, if you're a fan of Windows products, or maybe you're interested in an e-reader, now's a really great time to get a cut-rate tablet.
That's right. Amazon's Kindle Fire, the tablet, it was just reduced in price to $159, which is the lowest it's ever been. This is the Kindle Fire HD. So you've got some shelf clearing essentially happening here, where the companies are going to be coming out with their new products in time for the holidays, and they are trying to clear that inventory. Microsoft has been doing the same thing with the Surface RT.
Not that cheap, though.
Well, not as cheap as the Kindle Fire. They dropped the price of the Surface RT from $500 to $350.
And took a huge loss on their earnings. Now, today, the news came that a Microsoft shareholder has filed a lawsuit against the company, saying that Microsoft misled its investors about the fortunes of the Surface itself.
That's right. So this is a proposed class action lawsuit by a Microsoft shareholder who alleges that the company was not forthcoming enough about the struggles of the Surface RT, the tablet that's competing against the iPad. And their contention was that Microsoft could actually see how poorly it was doing long before they announced the $900 million charge against earnings. And that $900 million charge caused a 11% one-day drop in the company's stock, which translates into $34 billion in market value. So that is the basis of the lawsuit.
Now, you and I were talking about how poorly the tablet was doing long before that actually happened. So if you're a savvy shareholder, can't you just see yourself that the thing's not selling?
Yeah, why wasn't the shareholder listening to KUOW?
Yeah, hey, Todd had all the news. We are talking with Todd Bishop of GeekWire, and I have to say, before we leave the topic of Microsoft, he's no longer there, but we still associate Paul Allen somehow tenuously. And we don't have a clip of it. Maybe you want to play it off your computer.
Oh, yeah.
He's got, I mean, the man's always been a musician, and
he's
put out an album.
He has. This is actually his second album, his sophomore release.
What's it called?
It's called Everywhere at Once by Paul Allen and his band, The Underthinkers. And our GeekWire contributor, Blair Frank, has a much better ear than either John Cook or I do. And Blair reviewed the album. And amazingly, it's pretty darn good.
What type, how would you classify, sort of like mid rock?
Yeah, a soul, bluesy rock. And the smart thing that Paul Allen did, and maybe this is the genius behind his entire career, is he surrounded himself with people who really knew what they were doing. So some of the contributors on this album included Ann and Nancy Wilson of Heart, Chrissy Hynde, Joe Walsh, one of Daryl, one of Eric Clapton's collaborators. So it's hard for it to be really crappy.
I'm assuming that he compensates well.
I assume that those folks did not do this for free.
Well, there you have it. So if you don't want to buy a Microsoft Surface tablet, you can buy the co-founder of Microsoft's record album.
Almost the same thing.
Not quite the same thing. Although, you know, who knows? People seem like I've seen more Windows phones at least. So maybe it's a gateway drug to the tablet.
Yeah, possibly. I was listening to Katie's interview with Robert Horton coming in, and he was talking about his favorite all-time films. And I have to say, one of the best moments of my career so far was getting to interview Paul Allen on stage at Town Hall a few years back. And he talked at length about his love for music. And you know, some people do criticize Paul Allen for being a little bit scattered. He's not nearly as focused in his post-Microsoft philanthropy as, for example, Bill Gates. But you got to admire the guy for leveraging his position to at least, you know, rub shoulders, rub elbows with some of these stars.
So that's Paul Allen. I have been watching some television recently, and I've noticed that T-Mobile is running a series of commercials with the acronym JUMP, Just Update My Phone.
Upgrade
My Phone. And the sort of whole push is there's a guy with what I thought was a stylishly battered cell phone, because I thought that was hip that you had a cracked phone. Right. But anyway, he can't dial because he's going to cut his finger on it, but he has to wait until his contract runs out. But not if he goes to T-Mobile, who will let him buy a phone anytime because they've unbundled the phone from the service, and that seems like it's good for business.
Right. Now, it's important to point out that the JUMP service does cost an extra $10 a month.
It's
basically a subscription insurance service, but it's one of a broader set of new strategies that T-Mobile is taking. And one of them is also, as you said, taking the price of the phone and separating it from the cost of the wireless service. And one effect of that is once you're done paying off the phone, your overall monthly bill decreases. And T-Mobile is starting to see some traction with this. They posted one of their largest gains in subscribers recently. And this is their new CEO, John Legere. And he is, I would say, a refreshing addition to the wireless industry. He is at times profane. If you pulled a sound clip of his to play here, it would be mostly bleeps at times.
Mm.
But he is shaking up the wireless industry in a lot of ways.
Now, T-Mobile's still the fourth place when it comes to carriers.
They are.
Who is it? AT&T still in first? Verizon? They're up there.
Verizon, AT&T, and then Sprint, and then T-Mobile.
But T-Mobile is making a lot of headway to a move toward third place.
They are. They're gaining on Sprint. And it's in some ways a local success story. The company, which some people may not know, is based here in Bellevue, T-Mobile USA. It's part of Deutsche Telekom, mm-hmm. Out of Germany, but its U.S. headquarters are here.
Aside from the fact that you reap tons of money when you make somebody tie into a two-year contract, why haven't people done this before? Because there's you either historically have bought some crummy phone that's the to-go phone,
right,
version, and they're never the nice phones. They're always like the kind of phone that's 5 years old, or you indenture your life to a cell phone carrier.
It was in large part because it was not in the interest of the carriers.
Sure.
They call them postpaid subscriptions. These are the premium subscriptions that you get, the premium wireless packages that you get. Those are the most lucrative for the wireless carrier. So it took somebody in more of an underdog position, like T-Mobile is now, to be able to step in and say, hey, we don't have a lot to lose here. Let's try and actually give the customers what we think they want.
Who regulates the rates of the cell phone companies?
Gosh, that is a great question. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, if you're listening, regulators, it's really expensive to have a cell phone with a data package.
Yeah, it is. It is. There are a variety of areas of government oversight. For example, when cell phone and wireless carriers want to merge, it's, the Justice Department and the FTC and those types of things. But in terms of the actual rates, that's actually something to dig into.
Yeah, well, it would be great. Maybe we should all go to T-Mobile. We'll be paying less. Who knows? And last but not least, you've been covering the sort of abrupt closure of the headquarters of Contour. And this is a company that makes made. I don't know if they're still open.
Made.
Wearable camera technology. What happened?
Right. This company based here in Seattle, started here by a couple of University of Washington students. Just last week, they abruptly closed their doors. And they've been competing as the number two against the number one in the industry, which is GoPro, which a lot of folks are familiar with. And these are the cameras that people wear when they're snowboarding, when they're skiing, any kind of
action sports.
And
we see those goofy
sports.
Kind of film.
Yes.
Of the, and so do we know why Contour?
Essentially, that we don't know the specific reasons why they closed, but we know that they were in a lot of ways outgunned from a marketing perspective by GoPro, even though a lot of aficionados of this technology really prefer the Contour camera. In a lot of ways, GoPro has captured the mind of the consumer. In some ways, it's comparable to the Apple versus Microsoft competition back in the day where, you know, perhaps the larger company was not producing technology that was as good, but it was able to use its marketing muscle to really gain share.
How large a demand is there for a wearable camera?
It's certainly not on the level of smartphones. It's still somewhat niche, but you know, GoPro has raised tens and tens of millions of dollars from folks, including Foxconn, the manufacturer out of Asia that makes all the iPhones.
Yeah.
So it's essentially something that has a lot of potential, and you've got this strong competitor leading the field.
Well, I was at a wedding over the past weekend, and one thing that really struck me was that as the bride and groom, got up to the altar, they did not have cameras,
okay,
but everybody in the audience pulled out a telephone or a little digital camera to capture the moment themselves. So, this slew of hands comes up, which got me to thinking about the ubiquity of cameras in our pockets, cameras on our phone. We're all going to post this to Facebook or Twitter or whatever, just to our home pages. So the idea of a more cumbersome technology like a wearable camera, at some point you just stick the cell phone in your pocket at the top of the ski run and you could probably just tape it to your forehead.
Well, absolutely. And this is where things are headed. If you look at things like Google Glass, where there's essentially an eyeglass type of device that has camera technology, somewhat controversially built into it. And so,
yes, very much so.
Yeah, the line between humans and humanity and computing and devices, the line is blurring. And you're seeing that happen. And so in that way, things like GoPro and the Contour cameras are just steps along the way toward that future.
I just imagine yesterday I was stuck in traffic watching the guy heading at me, staring at his phone, I'm sure, texting. At some point, everybody's going to have these eyeglass cameras on, and you're not going to know if they're looking at the traffic or internal reverie.
Exactly. You're present, but you're not really there. And actually, it's a larger challenge that society is going to face.
Boy. And I know you will read about it on GeekWire. Todd Bishop, co-founder and national editor of GeekWire, an independent tech news site based in Seattle, where the doors are still open.
That's right. Absolutely.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Marcy.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hirsch. Jack Walters is the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, we talk with Pacific Northwest Ballet Artistic Director Peter Bowl, and we'll look back at 30 years of Northwest hip hop coming your way here on Weekday on KUOW.
KUOW News and Information. Have you got questions about the rules of the road? Former Seattle traffic cop John Abraham sets you straight today in the noon hour. You can get your question in now by calling 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
Hi, I'm Armin Alney. On the next To the Point, China's air and water pollution threaten the health of its 1.3 billion people. Now it's pledged $275 billion to a five-year cleanup plan. Is it time to slow industrial growth? Or will the investment in green technology save the country and the rest of the planet? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Listen for that coming your way in 6 minutes.
Support for KUOW comes from Metropolitan Market, featuring Peach-O-Rama, with peaches arriving daily from Pence Orchards and Frog Hollow Organic Farms. Metropolitan Market's daily peach bricks ratings or sugar levels are available at peachorama.com.
KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwa.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.